Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. This week, we had originally intended to talk about Stephen King's Silver Bullet, but with the tragic passing of Rowdy Roddy Piper on July 31st, we felt it would be more appropriate to discuss John Carpenter's 1988 cult classic, They Live.
Indeed, Sage. Of old, I must go on record and state that I have some qualms with this particular picture.
While we watched this in Auditorium 6, I felt you weren't exactly enjoying the movie, Projectionist. Maybe you didn't care for the over-the-top action.
It was not the over-the-top action of They Live I found to be the issue, Victor.
Well, why don't we hold off on that discussion until after the synopsis, my friend?
Gladly.
They Live is a 1988 science fiction film with horror undertones, directed by the legendary John Carpenter. The story concerns a drifter that has recently arrived in Los Angeles, who is our main protagonist named John Nada, and is played by the late Roddy Piper. I think it should be pointed out that Nada isn't a bum. His character isn't interested in a handout, instead preferring to earn his keep. Also, let me pause here and say that without a doubt, Carpenter was firing a volley against the rampant consumerism he was witnessing in the 80s. They Live is hands down politically subversive and a tweak to the nose of issues and government policies that Carpenter felt appalling at the time. John ends up obtaining a job at a construction site. After his first day on the site, Nada befriends Frank, played by The Thing's Keith David, who is our second main protagonist. Frank, upon hearing that the drifter literally has no place to stay, offers to lead him to a kind of shantytown called Justiceville, where a large group of people have banded together in an effort to survive and ride out the collapsed economy. Frank introduces John to Gilbert, played by John Carpenter alumni Peter Jason, who has set up the place with the help of his wife and friends, across from a small church. Nada quickly begins to notice odd things around Justiceville, such as Gilbert, who goes out of that church at all hours of the night, and the street preacher, an elderly blind man who delivers emotional sermons to those that will listen, that the time is right to wake up and see the truth around them. One evening, while wandering through the shantytown, Nada witnesses a TV broadcast being interrupted from a pirate feed, with a nervous man warning people about those that are in positions of power, declaring they are in fact aliens that have infiltrated all branches of authority, and that the human race itself is being kept in a state very much like sleep. The man also explains a small group of scientists accidentally discovered this hypnotizing signal was blanketing the planet, and that is what keeps humanity in such a state. The man on the static field TV warns that humanity has been placed into this trance to help further the agenda of these invaders, that we have been bred to become more and more apathetic to each other, paying attention only to our own gain in status and wealth. The agitated man also makes mention that a movement, a resistance, has been formed to free people from the alien masters. More curious than the pirate feed, though, is when Nada notices the street preacher, who is silently mouthing the exact words that the man on the TV is saying. Gilbert appears by the elderly man's side and almost forcibly guides him back into the church. John finds all of this intriguing and decides to go and investigate the church. Sneaking inside the back room, our hero finds boxes stacked almost floor to ceiling, as well as laboratory equipment on a table, with a couple of stacks of trays containing dark sunglasses. Nada spies on the wall a painted message that reads, "They live, we sleep." Although our hero doesn't know it, on the other side of that wall, an argument is going on between Gilbert and the man we saw on the pirate feed. The satellite dish in the room tells us this is where the feeds are originating from, and that Gilbert is part of the resistance. The two are arguing about the best way to get the message out about the aliens. The man from the TV believes they should distribute the sunglasses, which we later learn are what is in all of those boxes. John finds a false wall holding more boxes of those sunglasses. He is quick to set everything right again before attempting to leave when he is startled by the street preacher, who examines his face and hands. The reason for that will become apparent in just a bit. When John leaves the church, he notices a helicopter that is circling over Justiceville. Gilbert and some of those within notice this as well and pack up nearby vehicles with those boxes before taking off like the devil was on their heels. That night, the shanty town is brutally attacked by the police, sending the residents of Justiceville fleeing for their lives. Some of the police go so far as to corner the street preacher and then beat him to death when he resists. As John makes his escape from the mayhem, the police bulldoze the shanty town into oblivion. John revisits the church the next day. All of that scientific equipment is gone. Behind that false wall, though, are boxes of those sunglasses. After leaving the church, he puts on a pair of sunglasses and finds that what the street preacher and the man on TV were proclaiming is indeed true. Nada now sees everything perfectly in black and white, viewing the world as it truly is for the first time. Everywhere he looks, John sees that any type of advertising, like a simple computer billboard ad, now sports a message such as Obey. A travel ad featuring a beautiful woman at the beach, when glimpsed through those glasses, now states Marry and Reproduce. Throughout the city, John witnesses similar subliminal messages like stay asleep, honor apathy, buy, do not question authority, watch TV, and submit. But worst of all is when a businessman comes up beside him. John stares in slack-jawed horror at what is before him. While humanoid in shape, our first good look at these aliens reveal they look diseased, possessing gaunt skull-like faces, lacking a nose and lips, with large bulbous red eyes with silver star-shaped pupils. Wandering almost in a daze into a nearby grocery store, John tries to come to terms with the truth of the existence of these aliens, watching as they secretly mingle with humans. And at first, John's reaction is one of disgust, but it quickly turns to anger, especially when he's bumped into by one of them. Nada verbally puts her down for her looks, even going so far as to announce, rather foolishly, that when he takes off the sunglasses, she looks human. The alien woman speaks into her wristwatch, saying, I've got one that can see. John looks around the store in alarm as all of the aliens are now slowly walking towards him, speaking into their own watches, giving their location, Nada's description, and a request for police assistance. John is forced to become a fugitive after assaulting two alien police officers outside the grocery store, killing one of them in the process, and then starting a shooting spree in a nearby bank using the weapons he stole off them. Though he only shoots the aliens, but it still looks like he's a cold-blooded murderer. So in an effort to escape the city, he takes a hostage. A TV network assistant director named Holly Thompson, played by Leviathan's Meg Foster. John does his very best to inform her of his situation, but can you fault her for not believing him? Holly drives him up to her home in the hillside, and at a moment when he drops his guard, she knocks him through a window where he rolls down said hillside before she calls the police. And that is where I'll stop the synopsis, friends. John has no allies and no weapons and nowhere to turn to. How will he overcome this? You will just have to watch They Live to find out for yourself.
Well done, Victor. That was only 6 minutes and 50 seconds.
As always, projectionist, lots to talk about. Now, how about we discuss the issues you had with the movie?
First of all, I think you've heaped too much praise for John Carpenter with They Live. His subversive aspects in the film are about as subtle as a silk-wrapped claw hammer. But my major concern was I didn't feel that Piper was able to carry the film as the main protagonist. Although he certainly has some very humorous one-liners, such as the bubblegum one.
I am going to respectfully disagree with you about Piper's acting talents, my friend, but the one-liner you mean is one of the most quoted lines of a cult film ever.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum.
That would be the one.
That was actually ad-libbed by Piper. It was something that he originally had planned to use during an interview in what was then the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation. Projectionist, did you actually show They Live at the Haunted Drive-In when it was originally released?
I did not. It marks the only theatrical film of John Carpenter's that was not shown at my drive-in. Before you ask, it wasn't my judgment on the film itself. A projectionist must never allow his audience to suffer over their individual tastes. But as you know, I have to go through rather interesting channels to secure the movies shown at the Haunted Drive-In. I was not able to attain a print of They Live. Not when it was originally released on November 4th, 1988. Did you see it in the theater, Sage?
Nope. My father and I caught it at the 112 drive-in back in the day. We both loved it. Of course, at the time, I was really into professional wrestling. Well, what they were showing every Saturday night from the WWF. Piper, even though he played the part of a heel, or the villain in the matches, was always our personal favorite, so his antics in the movie really tickled us.
Like the rather grueling fist fight between Frank and John Nada in the back alley.
Oh yeah, we were rolling in the car at that scene. It's a really nice over-the-top moment in the film that I feel is John Carpenter giving a tip of the hat to all of the wrestling fans that were in the audience. Did you know that Carpenter was in attendance at WrestleMania 3 back in 1987?
What's it?
I'm going to take that as a no then, projectionist. WrestleMania, think of it as sort of the equivalent of the Academy Awards of wrestling. Although, no one gets any awards. Never mind. It's been said that Piper entered the director's skybox to introduce himself, and that got Carpenter to thinking about the wrestler for the lead role. And for that fist fight scene you mentioned, one that I will personally go on record as saying is the most epic brawl ever put on film, it was rehearsed and choreographed in the backyard of Carpenter's production office. The scene between Piper and David originally was only supposed to last 20 seconds or so, just a couple of vicious blows between the two before David's character would get the glasses slapped on his face. But after they rehearsed that fight for 3 weeks, Carpenter was so impressed, he kept the full 5 minutes and 20 second fight in the picture. John Carpenter has gone on record as saying it was his ode to John Ford's film, The Quiet Man, where John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin come to blows and proceed to continue that fight up and down the hills and streams of Ireland's Innisfree.
Now that is a wonderful film, dear listeners. And one far more believable in its physical violence than the one presented in They Live.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. But, as I've already made abundantly clear, They Live is not my favorite of John Carpenter's otherwise illustrious career. But I must praise his rather subdued soundtrack for the film.
Yeah, and you're still wrong about the fist fight. Carpenter and Alan Howarth delivered something rather different than what we had previously heard with 1986's Big Trouble in Little China, or 1987's Prince of Darkness. Almost a bluesy main theme.
The drifter character of John Nada quite well.
Friends, John Carpenter was not only the director, but the writer of the screenplay, using the pseudonym of Frank Armitage, which is actually a nod to H.P. Lovecraft, projectionist.
A nod to Henry Armitage, I would guess, from the Dunwich Horror.
You got it. The script that Carpenter wrote was based off the short story by Ray Nelson, entitled 8 o'clock in the Morning, which was published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction back in November of 1963. It was also adapted into a story for the anthology comic series Alien Counters for the April 1986 issue. I have almost all of those comics, by the way, except that particular one, which is a shame. In the original story, the main character, who's named George Nada, is attending a performance of a stage hypnotist who puts the man in a trance that, upon waking, finds the world itself has been hypnotized by alien creatures intent on ruling humanity. The hero of this story has until 8 o'clock to save the world. 8 o'clock in the morning. Why? Because he's been told that exactly at that time, his heart will stop.
How odd. I've never read that short story before.
Well, I have, and to be honest, it's not that great. I much prefer the way that Carpenter used the basis as merely the framework to hang his larger story upon. I mean, I really dig the idea that these sunglasses allow you to see the world as it truly is. There is no more abstract interpretations for those that wear them. There is only the truth. And the film aliens are so scary in this movie, I think. I kind of glossed over it, but in the scene after John is confronted by the aliens outside of the grocery store, it really seemed that the alien officers were hesitant to kill our hero. They've stayed in power so long exactly because they're a secret. They would rather coerce John into joining them, selling out humanity in exchange for an easier life and creature comforts.
Yes, which we see from some of John Nada's friends. That offer is too tempting.
Associates is what I would say, but let's not go any further there. Much like the sunglasses, I think I should point out the message in the church. They live, we sleep. Which I always took as a reference to not the existence of the alien overlords, but that they are truly having a life, enjoying the fruits of humanity's labors. While in the film, humans are ignorant of their lots, toiling to make things easier for the overlords.
I think you are reaching on that, in my personal opinion, Victor.
Well, you may be right, but that is how I've always seen it. You know, we continue to call them aliens and overlords, but a fun fact is, Carpenter to this day still calls them ghouls. Oh, before I forget, since we were talking about sunglasses earlier, there is a fantastic scene between Holly and Nada. Not just well acted, but well written. He's trying desperately to get her to believe his story about the aliens, and asks her to put on the sunglasses and see what he sees. Holly is treating John like he's a ticking time bomb, humoring him, not making any sudden movements to set him off. She tells him that she will put on the glasses, but tell the man what he wants to hear, just to get out of the hostage situation. He's looking for an ally, but even if she doesn't see anything, she'll lie to him. So what is the point of making her wear them? I thought it was a nice bit of logic from her character. Friends, I think that is about all I have to share for They Live. Projectionist, do you have any drive-in ads for the listeners before we get to the notable cast and crew?
Most certainly. And from the Philip Carey Library.
From the far reaches of a vast and distant galaxy, between your next breath and the limitless stars, comes a space adventure for all time, Star Crash. Join the cosmic exploits of Stella Star as she matches wits with the evil forces of Count Zarthorn. Star Crash, thundering across the screen in a theater near you. Star Crash, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
Yes, sir. May I help you?
I'd like two of those, please.
Hot dogs? Yes, sir.
And three of those, and one of those, and five bars of these, and a cup of a nice hot liquid.
Coffee. Coming right up.
Oh, and two bags of those peculiar white puffy material.
You mean our crunchy popcorn. Shall I wrap that for you, sir?
Oh, that's all right. My saucer's just outside.
They come from miles to enjoy our intermission.
John Carpenter's next film was in 1992 with Memoirs of an Invisible Man, starring Chevy Chase, Daryl Hannah, and Sam Neill, who he would work with again on 1994's In the Mouth of Madness. Roddy Piper, who was born Roderick George Toombs, was a professional wrestler from 1973 until 1987. But as an actor, if you go to his IMDb page, you will see he has 121 credits, with appearances in the likes of 1987's The Highwaymen. And in 1988, besides They Live, he appeared in another cult film, Hell Comes to Frogtown. At the time of his passing, he was working on a short film intended to become a springboard into a feature film entitled Portal to Hell. The short is in post-production and features Piper as Jack, a building superintendent who has to combat the forces of hell when two of his tenants open up the portal in the basement. Keith David has earned 246 acting credits with notable roles in 1986's Platoon, 1989's Always, 1995's The Quick and the Dead, where he co-starred with the likes of Gene Hackman, Sharon Stone, Russell Crowe, Lance Henriksen, and a young Leonardo DiCaprio. He was also the voice of the heroic Goliath in 61 episodes of Gargoyles, and was in 2000's Pitch Black and its first sequel, The Chronicles of Riddick, in 2004. Peter Jason has garnered 238 acting credits with notable roles in 1987's Prince of Darkness, and in 1988, he could be seen as Fedorchuk in Alien Nation. He could also be seen in John Carpenter's 1993 Showtime pilot, Body Bags, 1994's In the Mouth of Madness, 1995's remake of Village of the Damned, 1996's Escape from L.A., and last worked with Carpenter in 2001 with Ghosts of Mars. Meg Foster has 116 acting roles with appearances in 1980's Carney, 1981's Ticket to Heaven, 1983's The Osterman Weekend, 1985's The Emerald Forest, and of course, 1987's Masters of the Universe, where she portrayed Evil Lynn. Of late, she was seen in Rob Zombie's 2012 film, The Lords of Salem. Friends, I think that about wraps up our episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Hear our new ending theme? It's entitled Twisted Toys, and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud, and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
They must simply cry upon the pillowcase of a condemned man. But I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
If you are new to our show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. The Saturday Frights podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you could, click subscribe, maybe even leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
Excuse me.
Just survive.
You know, you look like your head fell in the cheese dip back in 1957. You're okay. This one, real ugly. You see, I take these glasses off. She looks like a regular person, doesn't she, huh? Put them back on. Formaldehyde face. That's what
that's
we got.
That's enough out of you.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.